Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
This is Barney Leventino. Welcome to another episode of Turn the Page, the Syosset Library podcast. And I'm happy today to welcome Kate Winkler Dawson, author of American Sherlock. Kate is an author, a journalist, a television producer, instructor of journalism at University of Texas at Austin. Welcome, Kate.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
We're very happy to have you here. I have to tell you that I happened upon your book really by accident. I was walking through the library in the midst of this crazy coronavirus lockdown. The building was empty, and the title just jumped out at me from the shelves. And I started reading Sherlock Holmes, I guess, when I was 11 or 12. My dad had given me the whole collected stories. And anytime I see Sherlock, it kind of grabs me. And I picked the book up. I said, wow, this is really interesting. It's a fascinating read. Any of our listeners who are fans of true crime, who like mystery fiction, who watch CSI on television, you have to read this book. So the question.
Yeah, quite an endorsement you just
gave.
Well,
I'm telling you, I've been pushing the book to everybody I know.
Fantastic.
I really enjoyed it. So the question becomes, why is it that nobody has ever heard of Edward Oscar Heinrich?
Well, you know, he doesn't even have a Wikipedia page, which was one of the more interesting things that I learned. I think that forensic scientists just in general are the people who work most of the time quietly behind the scenes. They aren't the prosecutors or the defense attorneys or the detectives, the investigators who are in front of the camera, you know, the people who make the headlines. They are the people who do a lot of work in the labs, you know, at the crime scenes, but in many cases, they're kind of anonymous. And I think that was the same for Heinrich. He was a really big name when he worked during his heyday, which was the 1920s through the 1940s until he died in 1953. And he was a household name because the cases that he solved were so bizarre and the methods he used seemed like magic, you know, it seemed like witchcraft to how he figured these cases out, that it made for a good story. It was a really interesting narrative for the newspaper writers to pick up, and it always had these really, really great headlines, American Sherlock Holmes, and, you know, all this razzle dazzle. And I don't think that, you know, after he died, anyone was really able to replace him in that way. And I think just his legacy died with him, unfortunately. I think that, you know, we moved on to new forensic methods. We moved on to even bigger cases. And so I think he just faded into the history books.
His collection, his documents and everything had kind of been sitting at UC Berkeley for years. Is his son still alive?
No.
Oh, okay. Now, I was about to ask whether his sons were involved in any aspect of releasing the materials to you, or it was just everything had been turned over to the archive. The archive was given over to UC Berkeley and was in their control.
Correct. And it was such a large archive that when it was donated in the 60s, they essentially locked it down, and that was the end of it. It is more than 100 boxes. And that doesn't even include the incredible amount of photographs. And like, I actually just talked to the archivist about his photographs for a different project that I'm going to be working on that I can't talk about, but I'll tell you about at some point. And so I was asking about all the photographs. So he was an avid photographer. He took all his own crime scene photos. And of course he had hired a photographer to take loads of photos of him in the lab because he had an ego. And the much of the time he used photographic plates that are volatile, like flammable, like the archivist said, they'll explode if you touch them. And they can't get rid of them because they're part of an archive. You can't destroy an archive. So they just are sort of sitting there locked up with nobody able to look at them or get to them because they could literally kill you. So that's the sort of archive we were looking at. It was, you know, I think that his son just packed up his lab when he died in 1953 and just left the boxes at UC Berkeley. They found loaded pistols. And when they found it, the UC Berkeley police had to come and remove the firing pins so they wouldn't be inadvertently shot. And there was, you know, I had a jawbone that I was handling. There were pieces of skull. There was a parts of a bomb. There was, for some reason, filled, used wax to fill in a woman's heart where there was a hole in it from a bullet. He made a wax impression. It was in there. I mean, just like the weirdest things you've ever could imagine. He included, and that's what made the archive so amazing for me.
You know, it's funny you're describing all of that, and in the back of my mind, you know, he's being called the American Sherlock. I'm thinking about Conan Doyle's descriptions of the apartments in Baker Street with everything lying around, and Holmes madly working in his chemistry. And it's just really the parallels are amazing. But this is real life, which really makes it interesting. What was the case in your mind that really brought him to the forefront and made him prominent as far as criminalists go?
I think the Siskiyou train robbery is what people were most impressed with. And that's the story that pulled me into his life. I was looking through a book that I refused to name the name of the book because I'm convinced that this book is going to have every single case that I will ever use in any of my future books in it. So I don't want anybody else to get a jump on these cases. It's a book on the encyclopedia of criminals, essentially, in America from the Pilgrims into the 70s. And about 100 pages into the book is the story about the Siskiyou train robbery that happened in 1923 in Oregon. And it was a train that was traveling from Oregon down to California. There were three brothers who tried to rob the train, and it's called America's Last Great Train Robbery, which is so odd because they never actually were able to rob the train. They used too much dynamite and blew apart the part of the train that had the money and the mail that they were trying to steal. So they were really bad train robbers, and they killed a bunch of people and were in the wind. They took off into the Oregon forest and disappeared, and they only left behind a couple of clues. And I tend to ruin, unfortunately, my books by telling too many details. I will say that, you know, the federal agents took a pair of overalls and were only able to find one or two clues, and both clues were wrong that they found. They pointed them in the wrong direction, and then Oscar Heinrich took the same pair of overalls and collected probably 20 to 30 pieces of clues off of that same pair of overalls that definitively told investigators who the owner was. And they were eventually able to trace it to one of the three brothers who continued to be on the run for three or four more years. But it was what has still been called one of the most amazing feats in latent evidence, collecting evidence that's hidden, and then pulling together a profile. And people had not really done that in the 1920s. You know, you hear about Jack the Ripper, and they did criminal profiling, trying to predict who he was. But this was Heinrich using physical clues to tell investigators, this is who you're looking for. And he was right so many times. It was pretty amazing.
Well, I mean, there was the other case in the book, and I, again, without giving too much away, where it's the same kind of thing. He's reading, you know, a ransom note, and he says, "You got to look for a baker." And you know, it's just amazing. Just based on the nature of the handwriting, he says this guy was trained as a baker because that's how they write on cakes. It was really, really amazing, his methodology, and he was in so many ways so far ahead of what was going on then. From your perspective as a writer, you also had to appreciate his note-taking on virtually every aspect of what he was doing. It's interesting the way in his professional life, as well as his private life, he just kept notes and notes and notes, which in some ways probably made your job harder too, because there's a lot more to sift through, but there's a lot there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good problem to have. I think a lot of authors have a hard time because you have this great idea for a book, a narrative nonfiction book, and you're then tasked with rebuilding the world. What are the characters? What are they saying? Who do they interact with? What were they feeling? And much of the time, the older the case, the older the time period, the harder it is to find those primary sources. And Oscar Heinrich, his collection had everything. He kept everything. He was for sure obsessive compulsive. He had boxes and boxes and boxes of personal journals where he detailed every penny he spent every day of his life from his 20s until his 70s when he died. So can you imagine how much that is? I mean, it was unbelievable. I knew what he spent on butter on May 12, 1921. I mean, you know, I could just go back and find it. He, I think because of his childhood, was constantly trying to keep control, maintain control, particularly of his finances and of other people, but really his finances. He was constantly in fear of going through bankruptcy, having things repossessed, which happened for him. So, you know, he's very much a man conflicted, and it all translates to his cases because he uses that same, you know, what you're calling the methodology. He used that same methodology in his cases as he did in his home life, detailing, and he created in criminal cases, he created this methodology that no one else really had, how to approach a crime scene, how to collect the evidence, how to store the evidence, catalog it, and then create a narrative that he could then present to a prosecutor or an investigator that could convince them to move forward with the case or, you know, likewise, exonerate someone who they thought was guilty.
He also did experience the frustration when verdicts didn't go exactly the way he wanted and he anticipated. And, you know, he seemed to have taken a lot of that at heart. Case I'm thinking about, I learned a lot more about Fatty Arbuckle than I had known in the past. I mean, you know, I knew the name and said, oh yeah, he was a silent film actor, made a lot of money, and he raped and killed somebody. And that's what I knew about Fatty Arbuckle. I learned a whole lot more here.
Yeah.
Story is interesting.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Fatty Arbuckle is one of those names that if you are of a certain age, you're familiar with it, i.e. if you're over 70 or 80, you've probably heard of Fatty Arbuckle. He was a silent film star, the silent film star, with several lions mm-hmm. underneath
right.
In the 1920s. And in 1921, he threw a big party in San Francisco. He, it was thrown for him, actually. He had just completed a film. He had a hit film in the movie theaters. And there was a massive party. Massive party as in the amount of alcohol. There were, you know, probably a half a dozen showgirls, probably half a dozen men from Hollywood that had all come in and rented several of these suites. And when he's at the St. Francis, a few days later, a woman ends up dead because of what happened there. And Oscar Heinrich, who is my forensic scientist, is called to the prosecution side to essentially convict, to ensure the conviction of Fatty Arbuckle, who again is the largest silent film star in Hollywood at the time. So it was a huge case. It was scandalous. And I think it's pretty clear that Fatty Arbuckle, while he might have not have had the best morals in the world that night, he did not kill this woman. And he certainly now, even now, has a reputation of being an abuser and, you know, someone who killed this woman. And it was not earned. And his career was ruined. He was eventually acquitted after numerous trials. But Oscar Heinrich was single-handedly responsible for causing mistrial after mistrial, because he was convinced using bad evidence that Fatty Arbuckle was guilty. And if you look, a lot of people don't know this. If you look at the cover of my book, there's a big handprint. That is actually Fatty Arbuckle's hand.
I was going to ask you that.
Yeah, yeah. Oscar Heinrich had to go down to San Francisco City Jail. And, you know, of course, Fatty Arbuckle's not really thrilled seeing him. And Oscar Heinrich rolls the ink. And so that's how I thought. Why not use his handprint?
I saw it here. I said, I had to ask you that. It's really
interesting. Yeah. So it's a, you know, it's one of those things where it was a significant case to him. And it created a reputation for Heinrich as being someone who was sort of inflexible. And so people ask me that, you know, I want to say that he was perfect and wonderful. He wasn't. He was a jerk sometimes. He was incredibly arrogant, i.e. Sherlock Holmes. I mean, you know, this is someone who sent six men to San Quentin's death row in the same year. So, you know, this is someone who had a lot of influence. He was very powerful. And I read probably 1,500 of his letters between his family and, you know, other people he worked with. And I never once saw a doubt of insecurity about his professional work in a case. He had plenty of personal insecurity that's in the book, but he never doubted his conclusions. Never, never. That's problematic. I mean, that's you have to be able to admit that you can make a mistake. Even as a scientist, you feel like you have this definitive evidence. And that is why this book, for me, is a condemnation of what's wrong with the justice system now, which is our reliance on bad evidence, fake mm-hmm. evidence, fake science. So that's all part of the book, too.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You talk about his insecurity, and on one level, as you point, he was confident in his own results. But his insecurity, I thought, came through in terms of his relationship vis-a-vis his competitors of the time. Right. He was really, really conscious of what the other criminalists of the era were doing and what they were and how it was reflecting on him. And it really reflects his insecurity in that sense.
Right. He was very competitive. And in the 1920s, you know, he started in 1910 with the first private lab in the country, forensics lab in the country. And, you know, during this time period, any Yahoo could claim that they are, you know, a forensic scientist. And so, you know, he would encounter these people who he called them experts by correspondence, which means like they took like a mail-in class, right. Essentially. They read three articles and now they're an expert in ballistics. And it infuriated him. And they would derail some of his cases. And it just like aided him. So he was very competitive. He hated being shown up in the newspapers. And he had a couple of Chauncey McGovern is who I'm thinking of, kind of a antagonist in the book. He has one in particular who really works hard to discredit him. Because also think about these guys are all guns for hire. I mean, they have police departments calling them, prosecutors and defense attorneys. And, you know, if Oscar's not available, Chauncey McGovern will be. And so, you know, it's really who is the best expert that they could get for the money. And so Oscar, you know, really felt like his livelihood depended on his reputation. And when someone attacked his reputation, he really was vicious going back. He did everything possible to discredit them in the media also.
He was kind of very much involved also in the acceptance of the lie detector machine. Yeah. In forensic science. You had a lot to say about that and about what the ramifications of the lie detector's acceptance in a wide sense, how it impacted justice going down the road, that the lie detector was really not the end all and be all that they thought it was back then. And he kind of embraced it early on as this is going to be great for us.
Yeah. I mean, I think that he thought the lie detector was yet another tool that now it can be used as an intimidation tool. It's not admitted in court. There's a good reason why. It's unreliable. And I think that now, of course, we know that, you know, the changes in your heartbeat and your breathing could be due to your medication. It could be due to so many other factors. You cannot connect it definitively to lying. And Oscar, of course, you know, his good friend, August Vollmer, who was the chief of police in Berkeley at the time, had a cop named John Larson, who developed the lie detector off of another piece of equipment that had been used before. And they used it in one of Oscar's cases, and it was the first case it was used in for, you know, a criminal case. And it was incredibly intimidating to the suspect, who was guilty. And it was in the priest, the kidnapped priest case in the book. And the suspect was guilty, but he was terrified, and it was a terrifying experience. So, you know, I really also with this book try to dump the reader into several scenarios that you really wouldn't want to be in. One would be strapped to a lie detector test, particularly in the 1920s, when it's much more intimidating than it is now. And another is in a jury room where everybody is against you and you are intimidated. And these are things that still happen today. So that's one of the things I try to do with my books is, you know, we talk about things that happened in the past, why they were important, but also these are all themes that we have now. These are all things that people experience now in the criminal justice system. So I feel like reading it, you can really kind of connect reading someone else's experience with maybe something you hope to not experience, because it's possible you'll end up in a jury room like that.
Right. Well, that's what alternative jurors are for, isn't it?
Yeah, there you go. Get me out of here.
I got a chuckle out of that one as well, but and I'll let people read the book to get that line. It was interesting. David Lansom, yeah. Interesting story.
What do you think happened? You want to go?
You know what? I was going to ask you. You wrote the book. Did he do it or didn't he?
Oh, you're killing me. You're going to make me spoil money. Okay, so for people who haven't read the book, which I'm assuming is the majority of your audience, that David Lampson case is about a woman who's married to her husband is an executive at Stanford University Press. They live in Palo Alto in 1933. She isn't feeling well the night before. The next morning, he gets up and goes outside to do some yard work, and she goes to the bathroom to take a bath. And last time he sees her, she's in the bathtub. And when he comes back in, very short time later, in less than 30 minutes, she is slumped over the bathtub dead, and there's blood on every single surface everywhere. It's just like been an explosion. And she lost half of her blood in her body, which is incredible. So he is, of course, immediately put under arrest. They come in and say, you beat her to death. And Oscar Heinrich says, I don't believe that's what happened. I think she slipped and she fell and she hit her head on the sink. And I don't know is the answer here. I don't actually know what happened. I think there are a couple things, right? There is the argument that when you look at her wounds, they were accusing David of taking a pipe and beating her on the back of the head with this pipe three times, and then she would die. What Heinrich says, if you look at the wounds on the back of her head, they're in three swipes across her head, and they're symmetrical. They are perfectly spaced, and those wounds line up with the sink. So that kind of, for him, tallies with a slip and fall theory. It's a lot of blood to lose, and there are a lot of capillaries in your head. So I don't, you know, it's debatable. I talked to four neurologists, and nobody could really figure out what happened. Some said, yes, she could fall. She was only like 120 pounds at that. Yes, she could slip and fall, hit her head, and cause that amount of blood. No way. He would have had to have beaten her to death. But his blood spatter theory was interesting, and I will have to insist that they read the book to see that. The blood spatter theory, where the blood was really interesting. I think one theory that nobody had really thought of until I talked to a neurologist was, what if he actually threw her onto the sink? So there's no pipe involved, but it would account for the markings on the back of the head as well as the force. I don't think he did it. I mean, I think when you read what he was doing, I mean, he was outside with his shirt off tending to a garden, and he invited a real estate agent and her client to come inside. And that's when he discovered the body. It just seems like, you know, I don't even think that a psychopath could pull that off. It was pretty unbelievable.
He was pretty calm, cool, and collected.
Yeah. And then he becomes a successful author later on. So I don't know. It's all sort of up in the air, but here's the point of that story. The point is that there are, there's a mistrial. There's a, an appeal that goes all the way up to the state Supreme Court. And the point is that it was so tangled that it almost didn't matter whether he killed her or not, because the law says if you can't prove it, the person has to go free. And that's infuriating to so many people, including me, except if I'm the person who is being accused, then I am grateful that without enough evidence, an innocent person is going free. So it just works both ways. It's imperfect, but, you know, whether or not he did it or not at some point was, not the point. The point was that you cannot put somebody in prison guessing and thinking and suspecting. You have to be able to prove it. So there you go. So there is my non-answer.
There you go. And with that, I'm going to come back and I'm going to tell everybody listening, pick up the book. In fact, while we were doing the little talk here, I just got a message from one of my colleagues who was planning on joining us for a little bit, but she couldn't get in. She said she started reading the book. She said she loves it. And she's
fantastic.
She's engrossed.
Thank you.
So everybody out there, read American Sherlock. It's terrific.
I appreciate it.
I thank you so, so much for joining us. I look forward to your next. And as an aside, back to the Fatty Arbuckle story, I actually then on Amazon Prime, you can get Sherlock Jr.
Oh, yeah.
and I watched that, and that was terrific. So again, read the book, and you'll find out about Buster Keaton and Sherlock Jr.
Yep. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us, and stay safe. It's a crazy world.
Yeah,
and,
seriously.
I look forward to you next.
Thank you.
Thanks a million. Bye-bye. Bye. And let me stop recording.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.